25% of the class this year. Questions? So we've been working on approximation methods, and perturbation theory is a great approximation method. Kind of its ultimate form is Feynman diagrams. Another great approximation method is the Rayleigh-Ritzer variational method. So it's common and it's accurate. It's really only good for the ground state and maybe the first excited state, so it's got a little bit of problems that way, but it's pretty easily done. You just take any old function you want and you calculate this expectation value of the energy, and it's guaranteed to be greater than or equal to the actual energy. Obviously, some functions are better than others, and kind of the best game is to put some adjustable parameters in your function and then get this quantity to be as small as possible, and then you have the closest possible upper limit to the actual eigenenergy. We also showed that this had quadratic accuracy, that is to say, to the extent that this function misses the exact eigenfunction, the errors in energy are kind of proportional to those deviations squared. So that's good. Quadratic accuracy is better than linear accuracy. So we did some examples. The kind of example we'll be following up today is the delta function example. So if we go to dimensionless coordinates, here we have a molecule that has a delta function at x equals a, delta function at x equals minus a, kind of like two nuclei, and we're interested in the wave function that goes all the way around it. And what we did last time is we used Gaussians to approximate those wave functions. And the results weren't particularly great, I guess I would say, because the wave function wasn't particularly great. So the real wave function has these kinks that come from having an absolute value. And they're just simple exponentials, whereas the Gaussian is e to the minus x squared as opposed to just e to the minus x. And so the Gaussian falls off too fast and it has the wrong shape here, but it has the same kind of general shape and it had kind of generally the right energy, but maybe not perfect energy. I comment that in the previous lecture, A was the adjustable parameter that we had in our Gaussian. And what we're going to talk about today is not going to have any adjustable parameters. And instead, A is going to be the location of the delta function nuclei. So potential degenerate notation. Questions? Okay, so really, I would say for no particularly good reason, Griffiths uses this moment to talk about, I would say, kind of an old-fashioned method for chemical calculations called linear combinations of atomic orbitals. And it was great, I think, in 1930. Bohr's original quantum mechanics had no chance of dealing with a two-center problem like an H2 molecule. You couldn't even begin to do it using Bohr's method. And with just maybe two sides of a piece of paper, you could get ballpark values for the size of molecules, the bond length, the bond energies. Times have advanced. I sure hope no one's using this method today because there are much better methods available. But it still shows that we can get pretty far with relatively little algebra. But frankly, probably too much algebra for the blackboard. So we're going to simplify this a little bit. But the basic idea is that if we have, a real H2 So just one electron, two protons. We know that the wave function is going to be some sort of symmetric function like that. And, you know, why not, as a trial wave function, just take a linear combination of the 1s wave function of this guy here. Let me call that the minus guy, and a 1s wave function sitting on top of the other guy. We can happily calculate, using the variational method, the expectation value of that energy, and whatever we get, we're guaranteed that it's going to be more than the bound state energy. What makes this less than perfect is that there's no adjustable parameters, right? So we can't, to the extent that this wave function is not the right wave function, we're going to get deviations. And it's usually nice to have some adjustable wave functions in your calculations. And the other thing that is less than perfect about this method, from a modern computational point of view, is if you remember the formulas for the hydrogen atom wave function, they're moderately complicated, right? They have this Lagrange polynomials, they have different exponents. And it's just a little bit awkward to do computer calculations with those particular functions. So lack of adjustable parameters and kind of computational complexity, as you'll see, algebraic simplicity, but you know, kind of computers don't care if the algebra is easy, they'd rather do complicated problems. Okay, so that's kind of the ballpark. We're going to be looking at these sorts of wave functions, and as much as any, we can get, as I say, reasonably good ballpark sort of estimates for the size of atoms based on this sort of technique. But I think as much as anything else, the reason for talking about it is the nomenclature that develops, the so-called overlap integrals, direct integrals, exchange integrals. That nomenclature is still with us, even if the method isn't particularly with us. Okay, so this method, Griffith, well, he punts when he actually wants to calculate the integrals. I guess he puts them into problems, but it's probably too complicated to do on the blackboard. As I say, those wave functions are not super nice algebraically. So instead of dealing with the real hydrogen atom, my plan is to deal with the simplified version we have of it, this one-dimensional delta function problem, where I've got delta functions that are separated by A from the original situation. And in past, we made a trial wave function of Gaussians that had adjustable parameters, and that's not what we're going to do this time. We're going to use the known solution to the isolated problem. So we're just going to put these two together to make various sorts of functions with no adjustable parameters. Whatever we get is guaranteed to be an upper limit to the energy. And one of the nice things that's good about the delta function approximation is we actually can calculate what the actual energy is. I think I've told you before, H2 plus is solvable, but anytime I've looked at the solution, it's been too much for me to think about. It's pretty ugly for something that's called solvable. And I've never seen anybody write, is that an overstatement? It's certainly not in any typical graduate textbooks. It's multiple pages long in order to make much progress. Okay, so the functions we're going to be considering then are going to be linear combinations of these atomic orbitals, as I say, with no adjustable parameters. So I'm going to have e to the minus absolute value of x minus a plus, and we might as well look at the antisymmetric combinations too, e to the minus absolute value of x plus a. So this one is centered on this location, this one is centered on that location, and instead of actually writing down these functions, let's just invent names for them, right? So this one is centered on the right nuclei, and this one is centered on the left nuclei. So let me just call them F plus and F minus. Okay, so then it's off to the races to calculate these quantities. So if I want to calculate the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, and again, things are much easier in dimensionless coordinates, so we'll use those results. What we've got then is the integral of F plus, plus minus, F minus, and then our Hamiltonian. And also let me just, instead of writing the delta functions, particularly because my point is that exactly the same formalism works with atoms, let's write these in terms of just general potentials. Call them V plus and V minus. V plus being the potential of this nuclei and V minus being the potential of that nuclei. Okay, so that's the integral we've got to do, and we can break it all up into lots of little pieces. When we expand this out, and let's focus first on using this F plus term, there's an important trick that is kind of the reason for using a linear combination of atomic orbitals. And that is that this combination acting on F plus gives us exactly the energy of an atomic state times F plus. So we don't actually have to do any of that derivative stuff. We already know that we're going to get the atomic energy, the 1/2, times that function. So what we've got then is one term that is going to be F plus E F plus. Now we have other terms too, right? So we also are going to have a term where this guy combines with F plus. So that's F plus V minus F plus. So these are the wave functions centered on the right with the potential that's on the left. And then we've got stuff that has to do with this F minus. And for the F minus, we can do kind of the same trick in reverse. When these two guys operate on this guy, it's going to give me exactly E times F minus. So I've got E times F plus F minus, and I can't forget this guy. So this is going to be F plus V plus F minus. Now I've been a little bit careless with my signs. These guys are all plus or minus, right? Because this thing was plus or minus. Okay, so that's a great deal, right? We didn't actually have to take any derivatives. We could use the fact that these were solutions to the atomic problem to avoid taking derivatives. And as we'll see in a second, this is not all that messy. Okay, so let's focus on that guy. So we can use the same trick over here, right? So we can think about all of this acting on F minus, and it's just going to give me E F minus times F minus. And we don't want to forget this thing here. So that's going to give us a plus F minus V plus F minus. And now we have to worry about hitting the F plus terms. So these two guys combine to just give me that, right? The plus minus coming from this plus minus, and this stuff just giving me E times F plus. And then I don't want to forget the last possibility where I have F minus V minus F plus. Okay. So the first thing to recognize is that the terms that I've lined up are exactly the same terms. Right? These two functions are exactly the same, it's just whether it's centered here or there. So when I do the integral, I get exactly the same value. And in fact, I'm going to use normalized functions. So these integrals are going to give me 1, and so what I'm going to get here is just 2e. So this function here, I'm taking the function here times the potential there. This term here, I'm taking the function here times the potential there. But they're just flipped of each other's, right? Where we have the nucleus out there with the wave function here, or we have the nucleus here with the wave function out there. It doesn't make any difference. These things are going to be exactly the same term. And these things are called the direct integral. And we'll calculate them in a minute, but whatever this integral is, I'm just going to call it D for the time being. So those two integrals are exactly the same. That's where we have this wave function overlapping with this wave function. And this is usually called the overlap integral. And we're just going to call it I. And these other terms, they're kind of mixed and match, right? So for this term here, what I've got is this wave function and this potential times this wave function, or I have this function times this potential times that function. But they're exactly the same thing, right? Just flipped around. These things are usually called the exchange integrals, and I'm going to denote them by x. So the result is, what we've got is everything's doubled. So we have e times 1 plus I, right? Because this thing also has an e. And then we've got plus d and plus minus x. Okay, so the other thing we need is the thing that's in the denominator is that. And this thing here is just the integral of f plus minus f minus times f plus minus f minus. And I think it's kind of no surprise how this works out. We get 1 because they're normalized. We get another 1 since they're normalized, so it's going to give us 2. And then we have terms like this, which are the overlap integral. So the result is that this quantity of interest is equal to e times 1 plus I plus the direct term minus the exchange term divided by 1 plus I. Okay, so all we need to do is to, and we can maybe simplify this a little bit. So this is equal to the atomic energy, and then we have plus minus, d plus minus x divided by, 1 plus minus I, right? That one was also plus minus. Now, before we actually do these integrals, it's smart to kind of think about how they have to work. What are these integrals in the limit of the separation goes to infinity? What are these integrals in the limit that the separation goes to 0? So if the separation goes to infinity, these guys are now infinitely far apart. The overlap is going to go to 0. And if the overlap goes to 0, all of these integrals have to go to 0. Because they all basically involve this one here, this direct term would involve the wave function at 1, but the potential is infinitely far away. So there's going to be an infinitesimal effect. So all of these guys, I, D, X, all of those things are expected to go to 0 when they're infinitely separated. And so when they're infinitely separated, we get just the atomic energy. And that's good, because that's the right answer. So in the limit of infinite separation, this linear combination of atomic orbitals gives us the right answer. How about in the limit that the separation goes to 0? Well, if the separation goes to 0, then these integrals are right on top of each other. And so I is going to go to 1, because it's the same thing as the normalization integral. And what's going to happen for the direct term and the exchange term, well, these two integrals are the same, and this is the same potential. So these are both going to go to the average value of the potential. And we can see that this is problematic, right? If I goes to 1 and we got a minus sign, it's not going to work. And in fact, this is almost always the wrong answer, or at least a not accurate answer. I mean, it's always an upper bound, but it's not going to be a good upper bound in the limit that the nuclei are close together. Okay, so we have a method that we know is not going to do a good job if the nuclei are on top of each other. It's going to do a good job if they're far apart. So for real separations, it's probably going to do, you know, kind of an okay job. And that's pretty much the case. Okay, so off to the races to actually do these integrals. So I repeat, I'm talking about delta functions, but it's exactly the same if these are atomic functions. Right? Everything so far is exactly the same. We get exactly the same expansion, exactly the same terms, direct overlap and exchange. The only thing that starts to be different is when we actually do the integrals. And as I say, the integrals are kind of a mess. They're a page of algebra sort of mess. Quite doable, but maybe not doable on a blackboard. Okay, but they are very doable for the delta function. So if we look at the direct integral, we're supposed to use the wave function, say, that's on the left and the potential that's on the right. So this would be the integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus x plus a squared, right? Two of those guys. And then we'd have a delta function. The potential is minus delta function of x minus a. Yeah, easy integral to do, right? All we have to do is to replace x with a every place. So what we're going to get is minus e to the minus 4a. Right? Here we get 2a, and when we square it, we get 4a. Satisfies these conditions, right? So when the infinite separation, d is going to go to 0. And when we put them on top of each other, then d is going to go to 1, which is the expectation value of the potential. So might be the right answer. So with the exchange integral, we use both wave functions. And we use the potential for one of them. And again, it's a pretty easy integral to do. All we have to do is put in x equals a every place. When I put x equals a here, I just get 1. So this is equal to minus e to the minus 2a. And again, when a goes to infinity, that goes to 0. Check, when a goes to 0, it goes to the same thing d went to, namely minus 1. So the overlap integral from minus infinity to infinity of e to the minus absolute value of x minus a times e to the minus absolute value of x plus a. Well, absolute values are always kind of a mess to integrate, and it'll be easier. This is an even function. It'll be easier if we split it into pieces. So this is going to be 2 times the integral from 0 to infinity of e to the, well, if x is positive, then this term here is always going to be minus x plus a. Here we have to still be a little bit careful. So I'm going to write minus x minus a dx. So what the absolute value is depends on whether I'm to the right or the left of a. So I better break this integral down into two pieces. The case where x is to the left of a, and the term where x is to the right of a. Okay, so here's a. If x is on this side, then x minus a is negative, so I want this to be positive. So this thing is really, it's really that. Or maybe I should write it differently. It's minus of a minus x. Right? A minus x is the positive difference between x and the result. And we have kind of a nice cancellation here, right? We have minus minus plus. So this thing is all e to the minus 2a. Right? 1 minus a there, 1 minus a there. And it's a constant, right? Doesn't depend on x. So it's really easy to do the integral. It's just a times e to the minus 2a. Okay, so if x is bigger than a, then the absolute value here is just x minus a. So now here we have a minus a and here we have a plus a. They're going to cancel. And so this whole thing is e to the minus 2x. And that's pretty easy to integrate. The antiderivative of it is going to be minus 1 half e to the minus 2x. And we want to evaluate that from a to infinity. Infinity gives us nothing. A gives us 1 half e to the minus 2a. So putting together all of these pieces, what we're going to have is I is equal to 2 times a e to the minus 2a plus 1 half e to the minus 2a. If a goes to 0, we get 1. Yep, looks good. When a goes to infinity, we get 0. Might as well factor out this e to the minus 2a. So this is 2a plus 1 e to the minus 2a. Okay, so it's easy now, right? We have these quantities. We can just plug them in, and what we're going to get is an upper bound for the energy for any possible separation of the nuclei. Now, what we've calculated so far is just the electronic energy. There's also going to be nuclear repulsion energy, right? So we should have a term that in general would be plus z e squared over the separation, which is a. Well, it's actually 2a the way I set up this problem. Well, we don't literally have nuclei here, but let's pretend that there's an extra added energy due to this that is 1 quarter divided by 2a squared. Positive repulsive energy, just to add things in. So what do the results look like? So the dots are the actual eigenenergies that we can calculate and the lines are what we get from this sort of calculation. So the first thing, of course, you can see is the line is every place above the dots. So this is for the antisymmetric case, this is for the symmetric case. This is 1 over A. So large 1 over A is where the things are getting far apart, or getting close together. So we can see that it's not working so good when they're close together. When they're far apart, when 1 over A is small, it works great. Okay, so we can then add, this is just the electronic terms. So here I've added in the nuclear repulsion, and now I've plotted it as a function of A just normally. And it's hard to see, so I've blown up the bottom value, just this little region in here, and you can see that there is a minimum. That is to say, the nuclei could sit at exactly this location, this separation, and as a result, we could have a stable system. Okay, and it works pretty much exactly the same if we do it with the atomic orbitals. We get this minimum, we can calculate what the minimum is, and it matches ballpark with what the actual separation is of the H2 molecule. The H2 molecule has another thing that makes it a little bit complicated is that it has two electrons. So we should actually be including electron repulsion in addition to all these other factors. So the upshot of these calculations, either for the real H2 plus or for our delta function version of it, is we get energies that look, total energies that look kind of like that. So of course, the idea is that the state will sit down in the minimum energy sort of situation. But we so far, we've been keeping these nuclei fixed. And there's no reason they are fixed. If they come a little bit closer together, they're going to have a little bit of extra energy. If they move too far apart, they're going to have a little bit of extra energy. It's just like a spring. And in fact, for a spring, this extra energy would be 1/2 kx squared, and this thing would be exactly quadratic. Well, it's not exactly quadratic. But if we're close to the minimum, it's close enough to a quadratic. So what's actually going to happen is we're going to have the molecule vibrating in various simple harmonic oscillator wave functions of the nuclei. That motion is a whole lot slower than the orbiting of the electrons. So basically, the electrons instantaneously respond to the moving location of the nuclei. And the nuclei are just kind of living with this total energy from the electronic and nuclear repulsion system. So this view is called the Born-Oppenheimer approximation. And I've said it qualitatively. I mean, we really should prove it mathematically, but in fact, we're not going to bother to do that. But we can, to a good approximation, because of the difference in frequencies of the motion, the electrons moving at 1% of the speed of light and the nuclei moving at much smaller velocities allows us to make this separation of electronic energy versus total energy. And the nuclei are just vibrating in this system. So we can then do another calculation and ask, what's the energy difference between when the nuclei are vibrating strongly and when they're vibrating weakly? And we should be able to calculate what light is emitted when the nuclei lose their vibrational energy, right? There's a whole spectrum of possible states. And all of that works out ballpark for this linear combination of atomic orbitals method. You can see, the curvature, et cetera, that we get from the solid line doesn't exactly match what we get from the exact calculation. But it's, as I say, for a ballpark method, for 1930, it was a great advance over what was possible just with Bohr. Okay, so the other problem that Bohr couldn't make any reasonable attempt at, was anything that had more than two electrons. Excuse me, anything that had more than one electron. So if we look at the helium atom, right, we have a charge of plus two and two orbiting electrons. Or we look at, for example, hydrogen minus, where we have a charge of plus one and still have two orbiting electrons. Or we could look at lithium plus, where we have a charge of plus three and we're missing an electron, so we just have two orbiting electrons. All of these are basically totally unsolvable with the methods of old quantum mechanics, Bohr's method. But we can make, using the variational principle, we can make pretty quick work out of these guys. So everything is pretty much the same as it was with a hydrogen atom, right? So now we have an electrostatic attraction that is electrostatic potential that depends on the position of both particles. So this is attraction. And of course, we have momenta of two particles. And all of that so far is easy, right? So this Hamiltonian, the way I've written it so far, is just the sum of the Hamiltonians of the two single particle states. So I could say then maybe that the total wave function is one of our, you know, say a 1s wave function for the first particle and a 1s wave function for the second particle. That state is symmetric, so I better pair it with a antisymmetric spin state. And of course, the energy when the Hamiltonian splits into a sum is just the sum of energies. Well, you know, it can't be that simple, right? Because there is electrostatic repulsion, which doesn't depend on the distance between the nuclei. It depends on the vector difference between the locations of the two particles. So this guy here is really kind of the source of the problem. It's a much more complicated interaction to consider. And it turns out that linear combinations of atomic orbitals are not going to be a particularly accurate way of going. So we will be better off if we make trial functions that have adjustable parameters in them. And so we might think about a trial wave function that was, these things are just exponentials. So that's a nice symmetrical function that has one adjustable parameter, and the integrals aren't too nasty to do. And it turns out that does relatively well for helium. But according to the energy that you get from this system, H minus should automatically dissociate into a neutral hydrogen plus a free electron. That is to say, the energy from this situation, the energy of this guy is greater than zero. Well, greater than minus 13.6 electron volts. So it would be better off as a hydrogen and a separated electron. Well, so another thing you might think about doing is to have the electrons that are at different locations. So you might have something that is e to the minus alpha R1 minus beta R2, but it's got to be symmetric, so it better be then e to the minus alpha R2 minus beta R1. So that's a symmetric wave function that allows some sort of difference between the kind of two electrons. And if I recall correctly, this wave function here at least shows that the hydrogen is H minus is stable, but it doesn't get the so-called ionization energy, that is to say the energy it now takes to take H minus and break it apart into its two component parts. And it turns out that in 1950, this was a very kind of important property, because the structure of the sun, and in particular the structure of the surface of the sun, actually depends on the existence of this H minus ion. So people were, you won't be able to calculate the properties of the sun accurately if you don't know what the ionization energy is of H minus. So this was on the agenda in 1950, and what you really want to have is a wave function that pays attention to the vector difference between R1 and R2. Right? Having the electrons having the same radius from the nuclei, but in opposite directions, that's not going to do much, right? This electrostatic repulsion is going to be small. On the other hand, having them at different radiuses, but in the same direction, is going to count for a lot. So far, these wave functions haven't cared about the orientation of R1 and R2. They've only cared about the relative size of R1 and R2. So we can do a little bit better if we think about a wave function like that. It turns out that, you know, with a few sheets of paper, you can do all of the integrals required for this wave function. It works particularly nicely, of course, because we'll get a cancellation when we have that factor with that potential energy. So this is not particularly a physically obvious important form. You wouldn't write this form as your best guess as to what the wave function actually looks like. But on the other hand, you can actually do the integrals, and having adjustable parameters should work pretty well. So what this constant C is going to do is to affect the relative size of the wave function when the electrons are on top of each other. It's going to be then relatively small, or we could have these guys be well separated, in which case the wave function will then be big. That is to say, it's more likely then to find the electrons when they are at opposite ends than when they're sitting on top of each other. Okay, so these are all problems that are assigned in order to do. Luckily, I've arranged it so you don't actually have to do any of the integrals. What we have is a problem for this last case, which is a little bit tricky because we have, so let me back up a second. So what we've done so far is we've looked at cases where we had one parameter, one adjustable parameter in our function. And so when we calculated the variational quantity of interest, this thing was in the end just a function of one variable. And while this function could be a mess, what we could always do is plot it. And we could see, roughly speaking, where the minimum was. And then there are routines in Mathematica that, given a good starting guess, will do the final job of finding out pretty precisely where this minimum is. Well, what do we do when we have two adjustable parameters? Then kind of how do we eyeball it to find where the minimum is? Well, I think the best guess under those circumstances is to make a contour plot, right? So you make a contour plot of your two parameters, and you know, you get these various contours, and you can see kind of where the minimum is, and you can give that as a starting point for finding the minimum value for this ratio. Well, what do you do with three parameters? Because you can't make three-dimensional things on a piece of paper. And what I suggest is kind of the best way to do it is to make a series of two-dimensional plots, stack them up, and then you can use Mathematica's animation feature in order to find the stack that has the smallest possible value. So you can work your way through the stack one after another, and see where the minimum on the first one grows, so it must be getting even smaller there, and then shrinks out the other side. Once you give Mathematica a reasonable starting point, it can then iterate down and get the final value. So using this wave function, you can actually get the ionization energy of hydrogen good to two decimal places. And what I comment is that in 1950, somebody published a 24 adjustable parameter fit to the H atom. And then they got 4 significant digits for the ionization energy. Not something I would want to do myself. Questions? So that's the end of the chapter on the variational method. So I don't know, maybe Wednesday will be a good day to have the homework due again for this chapter. So then we've got kind of 2 more chapters in our approximation methods. What comes next is a method that uses differential equations called WKB. So that's Brillion, I think Kramer, and Weitz. I should remember his name. He's my grandfather, as it were. My major professor's major professor was W. And after that, so far we've only considered perturbations that were there all the time. Like the corrections to kinetic energy, right? They're there 100% of the time. But how about time-dependent perturbations? Like a beam of light going by an atom, right? That's going to make a time-varying electric field. So when a time-varying electric field goes by an atom, what we hope to be able to prove is stimulated emission. Right, so we can make our lasers. And then finally, we're done with approximation methods, so it'll be a good time for a test. Questions?
So you're saying that, like, this is like not necessarily on topic, but you're saying that H minus and the ionization energies and stuff was like on the agenda.
So you should probably ask Todd. So are you talking about in atomic physics?
Well, just like in general, I guess.
Well, so every bit of physics has their own agenda. So I'm not sure what's on the agenda of, so what is new and interesting in atomic physics? So I'm gonna do something stupid and talk about stuff that Todd knows 1,000 times more than I know. Okay? So I could easily be 100% wrong on everything I'm about to say about atomic physics. So what I would say is on the agenda of atomic physics these days is precision measurement. So it turns out that kind of any time you want to get 12 significant digits, kind of the only imaginable way of doing it is in atomic spectroscopy. So our calculations of time, anything that's done in a precision fashion these days is based on these atomic constants. So measuring those and getting those right is kind of super important. The other thing that won Nobel Prizes recently in atomic physics has to do with something that you really talk about next semester, the Bose condensation. So we can make extremely low temperature gases and manipulate them in various ways. And Todd's been involved in all of that stuff. So like in plasma physics, so now I'm talking about stuff that Matt knows 1,000 times more than I know. I mean, what's been on the agenda for 30 years is to make cost-effective fission reactors. So in terms of particle physics, which is my original area, people are interested, so we've got the Higgs and people are interested in what's next. And what everyone thinks is next is supersymmetry. So there's supersymmetry has been around for 30 years. So what is supersymmetry? Supersymmetry is the weird idea that for every spin 1/2 particle, there's a partner that is spin 0. And we play games by adding S's to the words. So we have quarks and we have squarks. And the squarks would be kind of just like quarks, except they have spin 0, and the reason they haven't been discovered is that they have super big mass. And maybe the super big mass is enough to be created in CERN's HLC. It's probably wrong to give a short list of interesting things for any of these areas, I guess, because there are lots of things that are interesting. So I guess what I've been doing is giving a list of things that there might be a Nobel Prize for, but, you know, 99.99% of physics is interesting, but is not new enough to get a Nobel Prize. So people I knew at Madison, for example, were, one of the things they were doing that sounds pretty dull is they were measuring the magnetic dipole moments of the hyperons. So you know that there are excited states of protons, like the delta particle, et cetera. And one of the things you can measure, they're very short-lived particles, so there's not a lot that you can measure about them. We've known their mass for a long time. It would be nice to know their magnetic dipole moment because then we could compare it to calculations of how the internal structure of those particles work, right? They've got three quarks. Each one of those quarks has a magnetic dipole moment, and they might have some orbital magnetic dipole moment. And we should be able to calculate what the magnetic dipole moment is of a psi, for example, and then compare it to the experimental measurement. So there are 10,000 physicists who are all busily at work.
What do you think about the, I mean, I know it's kind of like a buzzword in presentations for physics and stuff, but quantum computing, like, do you think that'll ever become a reality? Or?
Ever is a long time, yeah. Right?
In the next 20 years, then, maybe?
So you can buy quantum computers now. But they are, you know, extremely low performance, and it's not clear that they can do anything useful. You know, they have the equivalent of 3 memory locations. I have been extremely skeptical of all of that. So I'm not sure whether I think I'm still extremely skeptical of all of that. I don't think in my lifetime there'll ever be a useful quantum computer. And the problems have to do with programming it and getting it to do, you know, general problems. If I am proven to be wrong, it'll be because there's a special purpose quantum computer that's made that can do really fast one particular problem, like factor primes, because that's important for code breaking. But I don't think you're ever going to be solving your atomic physics problems on a quantum computer, that a Cray or something will always be faster for any sort of typical computation. I should have turned off the mic before I made those predictions.